Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 5th, 2003. Today's session is entitled GMOs, to eat or not to eat, that is the question. Session 2 of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality, some new visions for the future of God's earth and God's people. Week 2 presented by Jim Bowman, number BOJ 2003-07. Let's listen in.
With Lutheran World Relief as Director of the Office of Public Policy in Washington, D.C. And we've been working on various aspects of the impact of globalization and U.S. policies and other policies around the world, especially as it affects people who are poor and people, which is really the people that we work with in the 50 countries around the world where we have a presence. It would be helpful for me to know if there are any here tonight that weren't in the agriculture thing yesterday that we did. Okay. We can't really depend on continuity, so that's always difficult to do. So we sort of have to sometimes reinvent the wheel, but we'll try to keep from doing too much repetition tonight. Just as a way of starting, I think it would be kind of a helpful exercise for us. This is the issue of biotechnology in agriculture is a very, very controversial issue in the world today. And it's a very polarized one. There seems to be sort of people over here on the one side of the argument saying there ain't nothing good about it. And the other side say it's going to solve all my problems. I think it might be helpful to get at least some of those arguments out in the open, and a way to do that would be an exercise, first of all, to just list the arguments that you have heard on the one side and the arguments in the other without getting involved in the arguments themselves. Just list the reasons why. Let's start on the positive side. What arguments, and these may be your arguments, they may not be your arguments. It doesn't make any difference for our purposes. What are some of the benefits or proposed benefits of biotechnology as it relates to agriculture? Can we just sort of list them on one side here? Did you just throw them out here?
Produce more food.
More food. Okay. Remember, now we aren't going to argue about these things now.
And also a reduction in chemical use.
Reduction in chemical use, okay. Reduction in use of chemicals.
Better. Increase in quality.
Increase in food quality. I'll say increase in nutrition. Let's just say quality of food.
And also nutrition by adding vitamins and minerals to food.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, what?
And also by adding the vitamins and minerals.
Okay.
Rice with vitamin A.
Yeah, increased nutrition.
Leave this in the category. Increased quality of food is sort of in that same.
Pest resistance.
Okay, pest resistance. Okay.
That's really reduction of chemicals.
It's not related, but it's not the same. It's not quite the same.
Yeah.
Because you can do it by different
methods.
Methods, yeah, right. They don't always involve chemicals. Okay, pest resistance. Any others?
Reduce
frost tolerance and things like that, which lead into the more food.
Okay, right. We should just throw these out when they stop. Right? This isn't any better. Frost resistance. Frost resistance. Okay, so that
more control.
More adaptive to more harsh environments. Okay, and what
more? More control.
More control.
Then it goes through frost resistance.
I'm sorry. What?
It kind of goes through frost.
With the frost, oh, right? Okay, yeah. Could be. I mean, it could be heat.
tolerance.
Yeah.
On the other side, I mean, it's right. It's all part of the controlling.
Reduce tillage.
Reduce tillage. Okay.
And erosion and all that stuff.
Erosion, yeah. Erosion. Okay. We're gonna have to really fill up this side if we're gonna get
it. There's pharmaceutical aspects as well.
Yes. We haven't talked about that at all. Can you explain what you're talking about by pharmaceutical aspects? Some the others may not be aware.
You can actually grow drugs in plants.
Right. We didn't really talk about definition of biotechnology, but actually that technology can apply both to plants and animals. It's not just simply limited to. I think most of what we've been looking at here are plant related, but we also have a whole animal related kind of stuff too. But right, pharmaceutical. Let's just.
We forgot increased profits.
Increased profits. Okay.
For the companies that sell.
Increased profits. Okay. We'll get into for whom later, probably. Okay, on this side. Now, okay, what are the arguments, without getting into details, what are the concerns, what are the fears, what are the,
The chance that the implanted gene could spread to non-target species.
Okay.
Cross-pollination.
Okay. This is hopeless. This is
hopeless. Throw them on the floor.
Yes, here we go. Cross-pollination.
Allergies to
some
of the cross-breeds.
Allergies. I'll just add some things here that would be the problem of, it's related to cross-pollination, I guess, but the problem of the issue of diversity, I'm talking about there, diversity of crops.
No.
Sort of
no.
What?
I don't know what you're talking about.
What? We don't know what you're talking
about. Okay, what you don't, I was in the hot tub, and I think my ears got full of water, so I'm just going to have to really holler or something. One of the things that happens, we didn't really get into that here, but a lot of this lends itself to crops that are grown in a sort of a monoculture way in large fields that sort of, and as a result of cross-pollination and other things, you sort of eliminate a lot of the diversity that's of crops that are, especially in places where more indigenous people have been growing a wide variety of crops that are adaptable to, to extreme climates and other things. So
it's a reduction.
Diversity loss.
Reduction.
Yeah.
Loss.
Diversity loss. Yeah. That's better. I'm sorry. If I'd said that, it wouldn't have been. Okay. Any other things here?
Corporate leveraging.
Okay. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Patent rights. And the selling of patent rights.
Patent rights. Okay.
Dependency on.
The dependency they create.
Okay, dependency. Creates.
It's less secure. I just read an article about that our food sources will not be. A terrorist could take out a whole monocultural crop.
That would be one of the implications of a loss of diversity.
Right.
Less secure. Which.
The long-term health effects are not known on some of these things.
In
fact, you can say generally in terms of impact. Long-term health effects, long-term health in the environment is unknown, I think.
Environment, I'll add that. this is something that's okay.
Addiction.
What?
Addiction.
Addiction in terms of do you mean anything different than dependencies, or?
No, not really, but I guess it's kind of the same.
Similar to that.
When you're messing with the foods in ways that haven't been done before, you don't know exactly the long-term effects.
Right.
And it kind of ties in with dependency in both of them, because you can get addicted to what you don't know what's in your food.
What's in your food, right. There's lots of these things are interrelated.
There's also increased complexity of actual farming methods to control GMO crops or herbicide resistant crops in the following years.
Now, there are just a couple of things that I want before we get really sort of into it. The other thing I would like to do is just talk a little bit about some of the... this is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, in the history of the world, and one aspect of biotechnology, and there's a real continuum here. Probably the least controversial aspect of biotechnology is tissue culture. The people who are on this side usually do not do a whole lot of quarreling with that in terms of it as a technology, and they've been doing that for 30 years. We're usually more thinking of what we call the genetically modified end of the technology, where they work with the genes to change the whole nature of the. One of the things that you haven't mentioned here, and I didn't put it up here, but maybe it's just because of the audience I have, but in other kinds of audiences, there are people who say, we ought not to be doing this because we're playing God. Now, I haven't heard that here. That's kind of interesting. Nobody said that, but there are those arguments. Don't mess with God. You know, this is the way it was made, and you're just sort of, you know...
We ought not to have been doing any plant crossings.
Yeah, that flies in the face of any hybridation, though, too.
Yeah.
That's right. I just wanted to throw that argument out there. So. I'm not defending that.
I'm not in the don't play God camp, but I think there's quite a difference between hybrids and gene transplants.
Yeah.
Putting animal genes into plants, that's something very different than just figuring
yes,
out...
Yes, but in the discussion of playing God, you still boil it back to...
Yeah,
it.
Right.
Yeah.
Any more than a domestication of animals going back thousands of years. What's the difference?
I think it's subjective. But that's not where we're going.
Well, let's talk, there's lots of things we could get started on that would probably take the whole evening, but we won't... I think it would be helpful... This man over here is from Canada, and there's an example of some of the... I'd like to give a couple of examples of the GMO, and I was asking him as we just walked in, I don't know if you're... I'm willing to talk about it if you aren't, but the whole example of canola, genetically modified canola in Canada. Do you feel comfortable talking about that? Do you want to tell the group what's happened in Canada?
Well, canola is a genetically modified... hybrid to begin with. It started as rapeseed. That's common in Europe, and one had a pretty bad name when people, you know, how's your 160 acres of rape? Then they crossed it with some mustards and came up with canola, a high oil seed content. From my experience of genetically modified, or more proactively genetically modified canolas, the herbicide resistant types come to mind, in which they actually isolated herbicide resistance Roundup or glyphosate resistance. and other herbicide resistances that occurred naturally in some mustards, and they transferred those genes through crossing as much as anything else. It wasn't any of this gene splicing or bombarding of a tissue culture with X-rays and seeing what mutants came out and whether they had any good traits. They now have like a different canolas, different soybeans, different corns, and they're working on wheats.
Let me just stop
which have different herbicide resistances. Yeah.
Let me just explain. You're much more technical than I expected. I mean, that's good, but I don't know if they understand. Some people understand what herbicide resistant things are. Is that if you have basically Monsanto has developed this product, so it's resistant. The crop canola, the type of seed that is grown, the type of crop that's grown from their seed, is resistant to Roundup, which kills weeds. So that you can go into the field and buy, and they also have the patent on Roundup, so that you have to buy their herbicide as well as their seed in order to kill all the weeds in the field, and what's left is the canola. Yeah, that, you probably understood that, but I just thought.
As well as you have to pay a technical use agreement before you can buy the seed, which is an extra $15 or $20 an acre, just to use the technology. Yes, you do have a reduction in chemical, but you don't have a reduction in cost because you paid the difference to Monsanto up front.
The same thing true with the soybeans, with the fee you pay?
I'm talking about the Canadian perspective. I don't know what Monsanto does here in the States.
I see.
And since we're too cold to grow soybeans, I don't know about the technical use, but I suspect that there is a technical use agreement. I mean, Monsanto is Monsanto.
There is.
Yeah, it's on either side of the line. They're still the same company.
A
particular interest to me as a farmer is that to use Roundup Ready canola is very useful to control other very nasty weeds, because you can spray it in crop and still grow a good crop and have a return at the end of the day. Now, the next year, of course, you will have Roundup Ready canola as volunteer. But one of the oldest and least noxious chemicals around is 2,4-D. Probably all sprayed that on our lawns for dandelions. And that will knock out Roundup Ready canola. Now, when you start doing that Roundup Ready resistance in grasses, in wheats, barleys, and so on, then what are you going to spray on it the next year to take out the volunteer grass? 2,4-D will wipe out. 2,4-D won't wipe out a grass. It only wipes out broadleaves. So, anyway, I'll stop there.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. I mean, what's happened also is that because the canola plant is so easily transported by the wind and birds and planes and everything else, all the canola has been contaminated. I've been told in Africa in Canada that you cannot grow any canola anywhere that has not been contaminated by that. But maybe that isn't.
I don't know of that problem, and we
I've
grow
heard
a lot
that
of
before as well. I don't know if it's. Yeah.
But the issue is that while it's contaminated, it's typically contaminated at the 1-3% level, so the whole crop isn't Roundup resistant, just a portion of the plants within the crop. So it isn't the whole crop.
And from a spatial relationship, that contamination tends to be only a few hundred yards into the adjoining downwind field.
There was a big publicity about the farmer whose field got contaminated. He didn't plant that. The neighbor who planted that contaminated his, I mean, he didn't go out there and steal the seed and plant it.
Are you talking about the Saskatchewan case?
Yeah.
He did plant Roundup Ready.
Well, he did.
I mean, he planted Roundup Ready.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay. But he didn't buy it.
He didn't buy it.
So what did he get?
All right, so he said, yeah, that's right. He said, it came over. I didn't, right. It came over to my field from the neighbors.
Yeah, right. Right.
And he was...
Via his cedar.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
All right.
So he's trying not to pay the fee, basically.
Right. He's trying to make it into something that it isn't. And he's lost at every level.
I think one of the difficulties in all the biotech areas, you know, is that there seems to be constantly new pests and new diseases that come along, and you have to continually be one step ahead to try to come up with a new seed that's going to be resistant to all of these. I mean, that's the problem I suppose farmers have had for ages, but that's one of the reasons for maintaining the diversity in plants so that you don't lose some of those plants who historically have been around for a long time. Another issue that came up with how many of you are familiar with the miracle rice that was developed, the yellow rice that was developed, was supposed to contain a lot of vitamin A and solve the problems of the vitamin A deficiencies. And it was really highly promoted by the. There's really about only four biotech companies. A lot of the small companies have been bought up or are being bought up as they are developing. So we're looking only at about four. That's part of the problem, is that so much of the technology is tied up with a few corporations, but. What was so deceiving about that issue was that it was promoted as a way of keeping children alive in Africa and Asia, where there was supposedly a deficiency of vitamin A. But what was not explained in their ads and in their promotion was that children really do not suffer a vitamin A deficiency because the rice doesn't contain it. In fact, in the new rice that was developed, the yellow rice, the GM rice, in order to get the required vitamin A that they needed on a daily basis, they would have to eat 20 bowls a day.
Oh my word.
So it would make more sense to encourage people to grow crops. The herb again, the diversity again, rich in vitamin A, such as beans, pumpkins, leafy green vegetables, and so forth. That's the way to approach it. The vitamin A deficiency is the problem. That's a better way to approach it, because it really was deceitful.
Well, but land that is suitable for growing rice isn't going to be suitable for growing beans and leafy vegetables. So,
well, maybe not in some cases. But I can't imagine that. Are you talking about what kind of rice? Swamp rice?
Yeah, rice. I mean, this vitamin A rice is a flooded rice. And there's not a lot of places in the world where that's an option to grow either. Let's grow cabbage or broccoli or rice. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if it was an area that was rice growing, I just toss that out.
There's also the fact that if you want them to give vitamin A through something else, you're telling them, no, don't eat what you're used to eating. Mm-hmm. Eat something else, which is fine. You know, better nutrition through education. But yeah, the idea was, gee, it helps. They can eat what they're used to, even though it looks not the same. I might understand that You also get vitamin A through brown rice instead of the white rice. You had to switch from white to brown. I don't know if it's grown the same.
I don't know. I don't know the foods. That's not my area of expertise either. I don't know what would be. But probably the most recent controversy in the news was, I don't know, remember when the GMO corn was sent to, was it Zambia? Zimbabwe, and was refused? And that really made the headline, and it ticked a lot of people off. And in the, this is from the May, this is from the New York Times. What was interesting, and it came out of, you know, Europe has a much more higher sensitivity to the issue of GMOs. They, for a variety of reasons, they really are opposed to GMOs and insist on labeling. The U.S. has sort of constantly said, we don't want this labeled because they're afraid that the European community and you know, won't buy the products. But here you have the U.S. Trade representative and wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that we need to, and it's actually now put into law in terms of sense of Congress. It's interesting how they slipped this into the bills that are passed. The HIV/AIDS funding bill on about the 127th page in a small paragraph, they slipped in a whole statement on GMOs, which said that if countries, it doesn't have the status of law, but it's a sense of Congress thing. We didn't notice it was there until after it was just sort of slipped through at the last minute. But it's basically said that if African countries refuse GMO corn and products from the U.S., they would be liable to not also receive HIV/AIDS vaccines.
Poor oh, George.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the old tobacco. Jeez.
So it, there's a lot of, and you know who's responsible for that, that little, what lobbyists were represented who got that in there. It's awful that, you know, I got notice of it the day that the afternoon they were taking a vote on it.
Oh,
and so there was very little that could be done at that last minute. So anyway, you'll probably read more about that. Fortunately, it's one of these things that, you know, obviously it can be quoted from and used as a kind of a stick, but it doesn't have much power, doesn't have the power of law in any case. What I thought would be...
But where aid goes doesn't have the... I mean, the discretion of where aid goes doesn't have the power of law.
No.
It's all discretion.
It's all discretion. That's true.
So the sense of Congress, despicable.
You can imagine that's going to be fought tooth and nail. I mean, even if it's in there, it's something that can be taken out too. So, I think that what I want to do just for a few minutes is give us some handle on how we approach this issue in terms of ethics, because these are ethics and grow out of our life as people of faith who hopefully think in disciplined ways, and how we approach these controversial areas. First of all, I want to give some rules of thumb. And they're probably, some of them are just sort of wisdom that you would expect that your parents may have taught you along the way. And the one is avoid all absolutes. All right? Nothing is all good and nothing is all bad. That's maybe a no-brainer, these rules of thumb. Also, allow for provisional answers. And I think this helps us maybe a little bit more. We may not be people who go to one extreme or the other, but make room for making a statement like this. I don't know the full answer, but at this time,
I must conclude that this position is or is not morally viable. In other words, you don't have to know all the information, but don't be afraid to take some position based on the information that you do know, keeping in mind avoiding absolutes. Okay? I'm just going to give you about three or four more. Here's another one. Keep the issue in context. By that I mean, for example, it could be theoretically now that a certain kind, certain area of biotechnology research might be considered moral in a country with adequate research safety. We talked about the whole issue of safety here, with adequate research safety standards. But that same research may not be moral where those standards are not in place. So that's what I'm talking about, the context. Keep the issues in context. Just because we would say, well, the safety standards are here, we think it's okay to do this kind of research. But if you sort of leaped over here to another country that had different kind of safety standards, it may not be appropriate to do it there. Do not draw final conclusions from personal experience. Okay? biotech must be bad because, you know, it harmed Uncle Fred, or good because it saved Aunt Betty's life, you know, that kind of a thing. Even though personal experience is important, don't make that the sole basis for determining whether or not something is moral or not moral. The kind of questions that I think are helpful to ask when we're looking at any kind of, well, especially about technology, is, first of all, what is determine the facts? What is going on here and why? And then the second one is, what should be going on? What are the alternatives? What forces make it difficult for us to move to a situation for what should be the case? And what are the sources of moral and spiritual power to counter those forces? And finally, what practical steps should we take in terms of lifestyle, public policy, institutions, social systems, and belief systems? I think that the descriptive question, what is going on here, is probably the most difficult to answer, and it's where there's the most controversy. Because people sometimes look at the same thing and describe it differently. Some questions that may help us guide us to determine what is going on here, some questions I think that we need to ask. What are the power dynamics at play? Who has the decision-making power to determine who eats and who does not eat? Who's making those decisions? Who benefits from this technology? Who loses? What are the long-term consequences? And we got that in, I think, came from up above there. What are the long-term consequences of the do the short-term gains justify the technology, even though there may be some, there we get into environmental issues. And I think, you know, most importantly, the difficulty or the critique of biotechnology that probably is most powerful is whose voices are not heard. Who is not part of the decision-making process? I think that those are the kinds of questions that need to be asked. There's that gets into this area of democracy. Are the people that are making the decisions about this technology the ones that are also liable to live with the consequences of whatever may come from that technology? In other words, are they the ones that are going to have to live with that? Are they accountable to those, or if they aren't going to have to themselves live with it, are they accountable to those who are going to have to live with the consequences? I think the reality is, especially as we talk about developing countries, many of them are not involved in the decisions that in the kind of technology that's being developed on their behalf. The reality is that, at least for Africa, there were, worldwide, there were about 130 million acres of crops planted to GMOs worldwide in 2001, 130 million acres. Now, at this point, Africa isn't greatly affected. We can give examples of that. Africa isn't greatly affected because 0.2% of that consists of land in Africa. So they're not greatly affected by it. So because a lot of the work that's done here is being done by on crops that are not even grown in Africa or in third world countries. There are about 50 different GM crop products now that are planted and harvested and are used and released worldwide, and none of them are grown to any extent in Africa, and none of the research there's beginning to be now some research facilities in I know Kenya has some places, South Africa has some places where some of this work is going on, and the U.S. AID office is under some pressure to provide funding for this to take place. But most of the funding and promotion are coming from private industry and private businesses. The other thing is that African countries do not have a lot of the safety standards that are in place, and there's a lot of criticism of the safety standards that are even in place in this country in terms of the research. So these are some of the additional problems. So who's making the decisions? So we have the issue of democracy, whose voices are being heard, and then we have another ethical principle, and that is correspondence. Does the solution to the problem correspond? The solution must correspond to the problem, and if your problem is any of these, obviously there is correspondence. But one of the problems that comes about, it seems to me, is that when GM, because of the promises of GM, such as where do we have here? Oh wait, I already erased it. They'll feed the people. They'll feed the people what they need. But if the problem is not that they have food, but the problem is poor land, access to land, water, inadequate marketing systems, then you can't promote this as a way of solving. There may be some partial ways of solving it. The other thing is ecological sustainability. That's another. If whatever dismantles, and this is the criticism that's made, whatever dismantles the long-term regenerative capacity of specific regions of the earth in order for short-term gains, especially if those gains are not for the people who live in those regions, it seems to me to be morally unacceptable. And finally, the issue of sufficiency. This is another principle. Let's see. I can't spell.
Question. Terrible. Question.
Yes.
Didn't God give man dominion over the earth? Okay.
To be responsible.
To be responsible.
Perhaps.
But to develop new things, new ways of doing things, to research.
And a stewardship.
I've seen that before.
As stewards.
That forever.
As good stewards of the earth, though.
Well, but,
absolutely.
Yeah, this is a way of becoming good stewards. It seems like get better production from your land, feed more people.
Well, isn't this the process for answering that question, though?
Well, that's
certainly a good question.
Mm-hmm. How do you answer that? I'm
hacking that out.
Yeah.
I like that ecological sustainability as an ethical question. Mm-hmm. If it's not contributing or if it's decreasing the longevity of land to be able to produce for people. And the profits that are being made are not benefiting those people, then that seems unethical.
That's not being a good steward.
That's not being a good steward of the earth. If you're compromising the earth's ability to produce long term at your benefit and somebody else's expense.
I think that's what we're talking about. I don't think anybody's arguing, I don't think anybody here would argue that it's not appropriate to make efforts to make sure that people aren't hungry. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody here would say that. I think you're raising the issue of you're raising something else that might be worth talking about. And that is how we in the West understand what role science plays and where the limits are in terms of science and technology. What are the limits? Or what is the role of technology?
And who's deciding it?
What?
Who's deciding it?
And who's deciding it? Yeah.
Because, even if we have domain over the earth, the people who are taking charge of the earth isn't everyone. The people who decide, the scientists who decide to go further and further into the research, are going to keep on feeding us the products, and we're going to keep on eating them without the proper information. And if we don't exactly know what we're eating, and if we don't know the research that's going on, then there's no way we could stop or let our opinions be heard. And so the earth has reached a part, like right now, some people may not want to be where we are with the technology that we have with cars and microwaves and all that stuff, but no one had a choice when it was being created because there wasn't that much information until it was just there. Mm-hmm. There was nothing to do but to just have it. And you go the same way with this.
Well, and the point was just made that that's debatable, and that's absolutely the point. Yeah. It is debatable, and yet oftentimes it's not until it's too late. And I think automobiles is a perfect example. And I'll use another example from LA, where General Motors bought the mass transit systems and destroyed them. Right? Which had, LA was what had one of the most fantastic. It's absolutely true. The red line in LA. And, I'm sorry.
Same in Minneapolis.
I wasn't aware of that in Minneapolis. But
it wasn't General Motors, but it was the.
Okay, and so the point is that I'm making here is not a plow is technology, okay? It's not GMO or whatever. The point is that typically we have a culture wherein we accept intellectual property rights as a given. Well, and I'm not going to argue that point in essence, except for there's a problem that comes along with that, wherein the owner of intellectual property rights oftentimes wields a great deal of power and uses that power, and there is no democratic process. Even locally, in the farming community, in this case, there's no discussion. The neighbor who doesn't want, for whatever reasons, to have his crop contaminated or her crop contaminated by pollen spread has no choice. There's no discussion. There's no voting. All these things that we believe in. There's no choice. It's similarly to LA. Somebody with a lot of money and resources purchased a mass transit system. The mass transit system was allowed to go to hell.
Where did you get your information on that? I've lived there for 70 years and I've heard that story.
Yeah. Well,
I know Autoclevin, the automobile industry, made the car so convenient that we all use the car. The mass transit was really ineffective against the outcome.
The land was not designed for a mass transit system.
No, it wasn't, but my understanding is that there was a mass transit system that was in, it was evolving in Los Angeles, and that, I mean,
I was there in the 20s and 30s, but not effective.
Okay, let's theorize, or let's suggest then, that my argument about LA and the mass transit system is incorrect. I still stand by the rest of it, whereby those with great property and power in resources have the ability to do a great deal of manipulation in a community or a culture at large in terms of how we evolve. And in terms of GMOs are an example. And again, I'm not arguing against technology in general. I'm arguing for a reserved, conscious approach to the question. There is no science anywhere that tells us that GMOs are safe. None. Because it can't be.
Nor is there any proof that they're not safe.
Intrinsically unsafe. No, that's absolutely true.
Yes.
So, and it's not only technology. Who wants a landfill in their backyard? Nobody wants a landfill in their backyard. Nobody wants a landfill in their backyard. There has to be a landfill someplace, but yet nobody wants it there. I am not saying that we have to have genetically modified food. Okay, but yet, if it fits a need, and let's say that Monsanto comes out with a seed that even after you pay the licensing fee and even after you use the Roundup, it increases the profit for the farmer by $20 an acre, and so the farmer says, "Hey, I can make more money if I use this." Then, isn't it his right to be able to plant it on his land? Now it is also our right that we should be able to choose whether or not we purchase that genetically modified food. And if Europe or Japan says we don't want it, they can pay a premium for non-genetically modified food. And I have no problem with that. I think that it should be labeled. And so that consumers can decide.
But yeah. Isn't it interesting that the industry fights very hard in this country for land?
It's also what's the definition of genetically modified food? Is it a hybrid between two things that hasn't been crossed before? An example, back in the 1800s, sugar beets had a 2-year life cycle before they could be harvested. Then through breeding and everything else, they got it so it could be done in 1 year. Is that a modified food or not?
If you'll excuse me, that's a good point, but I really think that the argument about what is genetically modified and what is not as a problem for labeling is clouding the issue. I think that any effort with integrity to sit down at the table and make a decision as to what is genetically modified as opposed to bread or whatnot could be that a very simple solution could be reached very quickly with people with good intentions, mind you, and I'm not saying who, you know, all sides of the issue don't listen.
There was a comment up here and then back in the back.
Oh, you had a question.
So I'm not. It's hard to see hands. Okay.
Can you tell the difference between a bagged cornmeal that has GM corn versus a bagged cornmeal that doesn't have GM corn?
I would give. I mean,
not
I
mean,
when I eat it, you mean?
No.
Oh,
by looking at
food testing, you can't test.
You can't tell?
You can test it for it.
Yeah.
You do that by looking at genetic makeup?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a chemical, but a genetic.
Well, there are some things you could test chemically. Depends on what the modification
the
was for.
Explosion.
Probably won't be doing it in your kitchen, I would suggest.
It depends on how much of it is there.
True.
I was just going to say, my understanding of this whole labeling issue is that, at least in the United States, if we were to label the foods that have any element of genetically modified food in them, almost every item produced or every item of food in the United States would be labeled, which really defeats the purpose in one sense.
I see your point.
Yeah.
So that, I wonder if that's true, but I definitely see your point.
Yeah, that was the upper. That's.
I would still want to know personally. That would make that be very
interesting. Just assume that you're eating genetically modified food.
One of the things we can talk probably a lot about intellectual property rights, but Africans are really concerned about that because there have been some examples where the plants that they have been using and developing over thousands of years have been patented by companies from the north, and they can't even get access to that anymore. There is, I have enough copies, I think, for everybody.
How does it relate to GM? And there, I understand how that relates to GM. Somebody patenting.
Well,
how does that relate?
Okay, it relates to how can I describe it? Let me pass this out here. That might be helpful. And then I'll come back to your question. What this talks about is trying to get community rights. Let me give one back. There's an extra time sheet. This is helpful in the sense that it shows you.
It looks like the same thing to me.
This was developed as sort of model legislation. It was done by part of the OAU, which is now no longer the OAU, but a different name for the organization. But what this shows you is the attempt of claims from the north over African agricultural resources, and they give you the example of the patents and so forth. A lot of them are medicinal, are in the category of pharmaceutical. They aren't necessarily, they aren't genetically modified, but many of them are taken and modified genetically in order to improve other characteristics of them. So it's not, you know, and so it's usually a variation of it that is patented, not the original thing itself. So it's not, that's where the modification comes in. I think the biggest issues as far as developing countries is that they don't feel that they are having any kind of input to the decisions that are being made about these issues, and they are having to accept the decisions that are being made outside of their country, and the decisions are being made by a few people who represent who don't have their best interest. I mean that's the concern that I have, you know, even in this country. I mean, it's part of this whole issue of democracy. You know, who's making the decisions, and that I have to live with. You know, I remember back in the 70s when there was the great high increase, a big scare about the availability of oil. And so we were asked to drive slower. Do you remember on the interstates they reduced the speed limit to 55 there for a while? And everybody was in Nebraska. I was living in Nebraska at the time. Man, you have to drive 55 across Nebraska. You're in for an endless number of hours. But I figured, well, you know, that to be a good citizen, you know, this is what I'm going to do. Not only just a good citizen, but this is sort of my civic duty, good civic, you know, duty as a Christian to be responsible. But, you know, it wasn't long before people sort of forgot about that. I don't know where that decision was made or how it was changed.
There was laws changed.
There were laws. Right. But suddenly, the no longer was it important to, you know.
The laws were changed back.
And the laws were changed back. So there were. But I don't remember voting on it myself or making the decision. I mean, those were decisions made someplace else. And I don't even remember where. But the federal government makes decisions about whether or not they're going to give you highway funds to repair your highways if you don't pass certain laws relating to speed limits, age of drinking, alcohol. You know, there are lots of those kinds of things that are passed at that level. And I think many times we aren't a part of those discussions in the same, except that's a poor example because it's government. But in this case, most of the biotech research that's being done is not anything that we have any input into.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. Yeah. Because in a democratic system, we do elect our
people. And we can hold them accountable.
We should know what they're doing and we should hold them
accountable. Yeah. But we don't have any. How would you develop accountability systems? A hand back there.
Well, it seems that an awful lot of people in Europe just have a feeling that GM food might not be a good idea, and they're not quite sure why yet. Mm-hmm. And they hear about shrimp genes going into tomatoes and things, and they just think, well, maybe we should find out a little more. And I just wanted to put in a word for caution in the light of common sense. And just as an example of where that could have helped us, how many people 20 years ago would have thought it was a really good idea to give sheep and cows meat? I mean, do you think sheep and cows should be fed meat? Does it seem like a good idea? The farming community across Britain did it because it made the food cheaper and the cows fatter and the milk richer. Mm-hmm. And we wound up with mad cow disease. Now, had they, you know, I'm sure that if common sense is saying let's be cautious, regardless of science, then at least the man in the street like me, I don't know anything about genetics, but I do know that you probably shouldn't feed meat to sheep. I mean, it just makes sense. And I could, maybe one can be proved wrong. But I think that in the meantime, if it seems like it doesn't sound like a great idea based on the way we've always dealt with nature, then caution is absolutely paramount. And that Monsanto and people and other organizations are not allowing us the caution that most of us, most ordinary people would exercise given the choice.
How do you respond to that kind of
statement?
I totally
agree. It's on choice. But what is caution there? Did you find caution? How many years are you going to wait for caution? Uh-huh. 50 years? 100 years?
A few answers would be good. Yeah. A few generations.
You don't have to count it. Only time is going to give you answers.
Okay.
Okay.
And we'll let part of the world starve in that time, maybe?
The issue for starvation is a debatable issue, though. I mean, is it because there's not enough food? Because all the indications are we have plenty of food.
In the wrong place.
In fact, monoculture, high-tech farming, can be, in many areas of the world, blamed for the hunger in that particular region. Mm-hmm. So are we going to compound that high-tech problem with another one?
Yeah. Well,
in the meantime, we don't have a choice. So.
Yeah,
worry every day.
Okay, let's let some other people who haven't had a chance to talk back here.
The flyer that you handed out is entitled "Smallholder Farmers." In the New York Times, about three Sundays ago, there was an editorial on subsidies, and one of the points they made was that part of the rebellion in the southern Philippines, where American forces, Bush has sent in American troops to try to to beat them down. One of the complaints of the farmers is that corn from Iowa, subsidized by American people, is sold at a lower cost in the southern Philippines than corn raised right there. Mm-hmm. What's happened is this drives the farmers there to bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. They cannot sell their corn, and so the whole system of livelihood and farming in southern Philippines has been changed for the worse, because subsidized corn has been coming in there and driving those small farmers right off the market.
That's happened. We talked about a lot
about
that
in another session.
What?
We talked about that in another session.
Right. We talked about that. That's a trade issue, a trade problem. We need to break here and pick up what materials you can here. Thank you for coming. And we can have conversations.